This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neal Conan is on assignment. Senators John McCain and Barack Obama meet in Nashville, Tennessee tonight for their second debate, this one in the form of a town hall meeting. The economy is sure to be uppermost on people's minds, but with undecided voters asking the questions, any topic could be raised. So today we'll focus on three domestic issues of importance to most Americans: Social Security, health care, and education. We'll discuss the candidates' plans and look at how the financial crisis will affect their ability to deliver on their campaign promises. NPR reporters who cover these issues will join us, and we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the candidates' plans for Social Security, health care, and education? We'd especially like to hear from people who are dealing with these issues in a personal way. Listeners who are on or about to be on Social Security, those of you paying for your kids' college tuition or dealing with health insurance, give us a call. What questions do you have about how the candidates' plans will affect you? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address, talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. And joining us now from Capitol Hill to discuss Social Security is NPR congressional correspondent David Wellner. Good to have you with us, David.
Hi, Lynn.
So let's go briefly over each candidate's plans for Social Security, starting with Senator McCain. What kind of changes is he calling for?
Well, and I'm not sure you can really call McCain's position on Social Security a plan, since he hardly ever talks about it on the campaign trail. And his website devotes a mere paragraph to Social Security reform. Social Security is known, after all, as the third rail of American politics, that politicians touch at their peril, so maybe that's not surprising. Still, I think you can boil McCain's position down to 3 points. First, he says he'll keep fighting to save the future of Social Security, but he won't raise taxes to do that. Second, he backs supplementing the current scheme of payroll taxes being paid into Social Security with personal accounts, which could be invested in the stock market or interest-bearing accounts, but not as a way of making up for a shortfall in the system, but rather to get a better return on money set aside for retirement. And third, he's willing to push for these changes, he says, in a bipartisan way, but he adds that if Democrats don't act, he will. Now, Barack Obama, in contrast, offers a wealth of details on his plan to bolster Social Security. He has 7 paragraphs about this on his campaign website with lots of specifics. But you can boil it down really to 3 basic points. First, Obama says he thinks it's neither necessary nor fair to raise the retirement age to address any shortfall in Social Security revenues, something that McCain is mute on. Second, he strongly opposes any privatization of Social Security, such as the personal accounts that McCain advocates. And third, and this is key, in order to shore up Social Security's finances, Obama wants all income above $250,000 to be subject to the Social Security payroll tax. Right now, only income up to $102,000 is subject to that payroll tax in any year. And Obama would still exempt income earned beyond that $102,000, but that cap would go away once you've made $250,000, and then you'd have to pay Social Security taxes on everything beyond that. Obama says that income would not be taxed at the full 12.4% that's usually split between employers and employees, but at a much lower rate, say 2 to 4%. And it's something that he says would be phased in over many years. So that, in a nutshell, is the two candidates' positions.
So it sounds like Senator Obama is saying that he wants wealthier Americans to bear more of the cost for Social Security.
That's right. He says he, in fact, $250,000 is also the threshold that he's set for not taking away the tax cuts. That is, that everybody who makes less than $250,000 would be able to keep the tax cuts that were put in place under the Bush administration. Those making more than that would be subject to higher taxes. Same thing for Social Security. He's saying those who are wealthy should be the ones to shore up the system.
Now, let's talk about some ways in which both these plans might be vulnerable politically. First of all, with Senator McCain's plan, this whole idea right now of personal accounts and putting any of your Social Security money in the stock market, I think that would be a pretty hard one to push for right now.
Absolutely. And I think that's why we've heard so very little from McCain recently about his advocacy for personal accounts. Anyone who's on the verge of retiring right now would be in very deep trouble if his or her assets were in the stock market. And it's something that clearly McCain would probably prefer not being reminded of on the campaign trail.
What about Obama's plan? How vulnerable is it politically, or what are its problems or obstacles?
Well, I think that he would probably catch a lot of criticism, and in fact he has, from those who say that those who have high incomes are also people who create jobs. They start small businesses, that sort of thing. And by sort of soaking the rich, you are also maybe curtailing the possibility of more job creation at a time when the country sorely needs that. In fact, a list of 100 economists put out a statement today saying that any raise in payroll taxes, which is this would effectively do for people making more than a quarter million, would be a drag on the economy. So that, I guess, would be seen as a downside of Obama's plan.
And one other thing before we move on to health care, how do these campaign promises on Social Security or these ideas on Social Security jibe with the voting records of these sitting senators?
Well, I would say in McCain's case, this is perfectly consistent with his position in the past. He voted three times to privatize part of Social Security. He campaigned with President Bush to this end also. You know, this is something that has been part of his credo for years now. His problem, of course, would be that if he does get to the White House, he's almost certain to have not only a Congress controlled by Democrats, but by bigger majorities of Democrats in both chambers. And pushing through a position such as the one he advocates on Social Security is virtually inconceivable unless there is some radical change on the part of Democrats.
David Wellness, stay with us, and we're going to turn now to healthcare. And joining us for that is NPR healthcare policy correspondent Julie Rovner. Julie, good to have you with us. Julie's
nice
joining
to be
here. Us here in Studio 3A. So, as with Social Security, maybe you can lay out briefly for us each candidate's plans for healthcare.
Yes, and unlike Social Security, both candidates have a voluminous healthcare plan, to which they've been trading charges and countercharges pretty rapidly. This obviously was a much bigger issue at the beginning of the year. A lot of us thought that healthcare would be sort of the domestic issue in this campaign. Obviously, it has been subsumed by the economy, but it's still a fairly large issue, and we've seen a good bit of debate back and forth. I think to sort of the headlines, John McCain has a plan that concentrates, I think, more on holding down health care costs than on covering more people, and he would do it more through trying to emphasize the free market and less government regulation, whereas Barack Obama has a plan that puts coverage first, getting more of the 46 million people without health insurance covered, and he would do it through more government regulation. I guess we'll start with Senator McCain's plan. The big feature of it that I think most people have heard about is this tax credit. He would give everyone a tax credit, either $2,500 for an individual or $5,000 for a family. You would get that regardless of whether you get your insurance on the job or whether you buy your own insurance, which would be a good thing for the 15 or so million people who currently buy their own coverage but aren't self-employed because they get no tax benefit right now. In exchange, if you get your health insurance on the job, you would start paying taxes on the value of that, which no one ever has before. Now, at the beginning, that would certainly, the tax credit would more than make up for the taxes that you would pay. But over time, a lot of people estimate that because the tax credit wouldn't go up as fast as premiums probably would, more and more people might end up paying a little bit more in taxes. So there's some question about that. The other part of the McCain plan is that he would allow people to buy in their own insurance. And remember, people could take this tax credit and buy their own insurance. In fact, a lot of people would be encouraged to buy their own insurance mm-hmm. rather than get it from their employer. You could buy it across state lines, not just within your own state. And you might be able to find cheaper insurance in another state that maybe doesn't have so many benefits mandated or doesn't have so much regulation. There's concerns about that, that perhaps states worry about healthy people, you know, going to the lowest cost states and leaving the sick people behind. Also, insurers could not sell coverage to people who were sick, and there would be new high risk pools for them. But again, it's not clear whether there would be enough money put into those high risk pools for those people. So lots of questions about the McCain plan. Also lots of questions. We'll move to the Obama plan now. There is no mandate for people to buy coverage. That was an aspect of Hillary Clinton's plan, but not Obama's plan. There is for children, but not for adults. There would be something called a health health insurance exchange to make it easier for people to go and buy insurance, something like they have in Massachusetts. There would be an employer mandate. Employers would have to either offer coverage or pay basically a tax to the government that would have insurance offered. The very smallest companies would not be subject to that. And there would be a new government plan, sort of like Medicare, that people could buy into, which does lead to charges of getting the government more involved in health care. And unlike the McCain plan, insurers would have to provide coverage, to offer coverage to people who have pre-existing medical conditions.
Julie, before we even get to, asking you about some follow-ups on the details of the plan, let's just talk about the political climate that whoever is president come January will be facing, and whether there's even the political will at this point to take on this this issue, which we've been talking about in this country for so many years and is very complex.
Well, certainly, before this huge economic crisis came up, everybody assumed that going into 2009, there was going to be another stab at big health reform, given the number of uninsured, given the cost of health care, given the baby boomers getting ready to get onto Medicare. The problem is it takes an enormous amount of political capital, and I mean not in the terms of dollars, I mean in terms of time and effort and just getting everyone together. And if this economic crisis persists into next year, I worry that there just isn't going to be enough time and attention to do something as big and as hard as health reform. It's not so much a matter of there won't be the money, because I think, within the $2 trillion that the U.S. spends on health care, there's probably enough money sloshing around in there to do a redistribution and make it work. But unless everybody is really ready to focus and buckle down, and the right congressional committees and the right leaders and the president making it the top priority, not the second or third priority, it's not going to happen.
We are talking with NPR correspondents David Wellna and Julie Rovner about some of the domestic issues that could come up in tonight's presidential debate, nominees debate. We're going to continue that discussion after a short break and take a look at some education issues as well. And we'd like you to stay with us. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about the presidential candidates' positions on issues close to many voters' hearts: health care, Social Security, education. What do you want to hear from the candidates tonight on these issues? How are these issues playing out in your life today? Tell us your story. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Our guests are David Wellna, NPR congressional correspondent, and Julie Rovner, NPR health policy correspondent. Joining us now is Claudio Sanchez, NPR education correspondent. Claudio, good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Lynn.
We haven't been hearing a whole lot about education, it seems, in this campaign.
No, we haven't, and for the obvious reasons. Everything else has taken over, whether it's the economy going into the tank, or the war in Iraq, or gas prices. I mean, it's pretty clear that Americans feel overwhelmed with the number of problems this nation faces. It'll be very interesting to see if anybody at this evening's debate raises the issue of education, because, historically, Americans have said education is a top issue, and at different points, it has been the number one issue. In fact, in late July, according to the polling that was taking place at the time, 84% of Americans said it was an extremely important issue to them. That might make a difference as to how they vote. Today, it's hardly a blip on the radar, and I think the candidates are responding accordingly. Education is not on their radar. They have well-developed platforms on this, but I think they've addressed the major issues, whether it's reforming K-12 education or higher education. And higher education really is becoming an issue more so because of the economy. People who say we're going to have to, keep our college students are not being able to pay for college these days, and the amount of money that the federal government is providing is limited, it's capped. And now we're hearing, of course, that the credit crunch is really having an impact on whether or not many students, first-year students in particular, are going to be able to go back to college or back to school in the spring. Because, again, the money is drying up, and they're hard up and they don't know where to go get it.
Is that the main way that the economy is intersecting with education in terms of people really feeling a pinch?
Oh, definitely. And of course, there are ripple effects everywhere. In the case of higher education, states are cutting back dramatically on the amount of money. And remember that public higher education relies heavily on state budgets or governors and legislatures giving them money to operate. And we're now hearing that, you know, universities, for example, that are also were investing on Wall Street are having to cut back because they can't recover the money they've lost.
Yeah.
Many were keeping pretty big accounts or big savings in even local banks. Some of those local banks are teetering, and many of them, there was a story last week about, you know, several schools, Boston College among them, that were not able to retrieve some of the money that they had put into these accounts.
Well, what about, though, federal programs like No Child Left Behind? Are the candidate, have they taken any position on something like that? Or?
Of course, with No Child Left Behind, you know, the Bush administration initiative to reform, to improve the quality of education throughout this country, both candidates support it. The difference is that Mr. McCain has said, I want to put a freeze, at least he has said publicly, you know, that he wants to look at how the money's being spent for now. He thinks that the law can be tweaked. Remember that there's at one point, there was literally a state revolt over the what many governors and legislators consider to be heavy-handed efforts on the part of the federal government to intrude on the way that local schools make decisions about how they teach and how they train teachers and, you know, how they help certainly the neediest kids catch up with kids who are doing fairly well. So there's this concern that once either Mr. Obama or Mr. McCain take office, that they will definitely change the law. The question is, who will water it down more? Mr. Obama has been careful to say that, you know, that he's concerned about the testing that is going on, that some people feel is really hurt the quality of instruction, that teachers should have some flexibility with. But the big question for Obama is whether he'll be able to come through on the $18 billion that he says the law needs in order to really make it worthwhile. Remember, the Democrats in Congress have long argued, and this was really the main point of contention with the Bush administration, that even though they both agreed that the law was necessary, Democrats immediately came back and said, wait a minute, you're starving this law, and it's not going to work unless you put the right kind of money in it. And Mr. McCain certainly has his reservations about whether the money that is being spent is being spent adequately. And Barack Obama has said, you definitely need to put more money into this law. It's one of those questions that I was reminded of when several in past debates people have asked, well, what are you willing to give up, mm-hmm. given the circumstances? And
They haven't been willing to say.
Of course not, because, you know, this is an important issue for Americans. But can Mr. Obama afford to say, I'm going to put $18 billion more into this law?
In fact, I think he has said that, you know, we have to support education programs. I mean, I think if I've heard him say anything about education, it's that he won't cut back education.
Well, you know, if you look at his website, it reads like a wish list of small and big proposals that call for bigger federal investment in just about every program, federal and local, early childhood education, Head Start, after school programs, college outreach programs, dropout prevention, you name it, and he's got it on his list. And that opens him up to criticism, because what Mr. McCain is saying is, I'm not going to make any promises in terms of more investment into public education, at least from the federal side. What I am willing to do is look at every single program that's there and see whether it's something that we need to have.
Yeah, well, that's something I want to talk to all of you about, but there are a number of calls here. So, and that is, you know, the whole question of, you know, what can they deliver on, you know, in the current economic climate? Again, we're talking with NPR correspondents about domestic policy issues that might come up, might not come up in tonight's debate, but are nonetheless important: Social Security, health care, and education. And the number is 800-989-8255. If you have any questions or are experiencing any problems in these particular areas and would like to hear the candidates address your issues and would like to discuss it with our correspondents, you can also send an email to talk@npr.org. And we're going to go to Hannah, and Hannah is calling from Atlanta. Hi, Hannah.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was just, I'm starting to apply to some colleges because I'm going to start next fall, and my family right now is in a pretty steep financial situation, and it's looking like I might not be able to attend school at all if I can't get a student loan. And so I'm watching the credit crisis pretty closely because it's pretty scary. I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, this is Claudia Sanchez. Hannah, you're one of probably hundreds of thousands of students who have who are looking at this very grim picture. The U.S. Department of Education just came out with some figures of, you know, the shortfall that it now faces in terms of the amount of money that's available through the Pell Grant. The Pell Grant, which is a 35-year-old program that was meant to help the neediest of students, is now $6 billion short, which means the federal government now, as the lender of last resort, has to come up with that money, because there's been a surge in the number of people who have either lost jobs and have gone back to school and are eligible for this kind of aid, or people who realized that they went back to school this fall and realized they were still a few thousand dollars short. Remember that tuitions have been going up well above the inflation rate. And so you've got schools, again, that are scrambling for money, trying to meet the demand of students who are coming back. And you've got a federal government program that, like the Pell Grant program, that is in desperate need of new infusion of money. And, you know, we're hearing more about people like Hannah, who just may not be able to make ends meet.
Hannah, what are you thinking of doing? You thinking maybe getting a job instead for a year or so, or not your first? I know that wouldn't be your first choice, but might that?
Well, I was kind of hoping that I would be able to go away for college and live in a dorm, but it's looking more like I'm definitely going to have to be getting a job and doing a lot of stuff that I wasn't planning on doing.
So are you hoping that you might hear the candidates address these kinds of issues in the debate?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to be listening closely for that.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling, Hannah.
Well, thank you.
All right, let's go to Kathy now, and Kathy is calling from St. Louis. Hi, Kathy.
Hello there.
Go ahead.
Yes, I have a personal experience related to health insurance. I am leaving my job with the state of Missouri at the end of this month. Well, actually, at the end of this week. I have health insurance through the end of October, and I have to accept insurance through the COBRA plan, and for me, for 2 months, my health insurance is going to cost $900. That's for me as a single person alone. I'm a social worker. It's a challenge to put forth that kind of money, but I am concerned, you know, even more so about families who are living at the poverty level, and how can they possibly afford health insurance if they're in a similar situation.
Do you feel like you're hearing anything from the candidates that gives you any hope about this issue getting resolved or working out for people like yourself or poorer than yourself in the future?
Well, it doesn't seem to me it's going to be resolved very quickly, and especially, you know, the health insurance has been as it is for many, many years. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how quickly, you know, this situation can be resolved. And for me, looking at things and being told that my health insurance for 2 months is going to cost $900, and I'm a person who, you know, I have some finance, you know, finances available to me.
Right. Well, let's see if Julie Robner can respond to your situation.
Well, you're discovering what a lot of people have discovered, which is that, you know, COBRA is a very double-edged sword. This is the ability that when you leave a job, you can continue your health insurance for 18 months, in some cases up to 36 months, but you have to pay the entire amount of that health insurance. And if you're for an average family plan, that entire amount is $12,000 a year. So that's $1,000 a month for a family. For an average individual, it's about $4,700. The vast majority of people simply can't afford that. And if you let your insurance lapse for more than 63 days, and then you go out and apply for your own insurance, then you're subject to the pre-existing conditions that we talked about before. And pretty much if you're over the age of about 30, almost everybody has a pre-existing condition. I mean, insurers can turn you down for things like allergies. Someone said they were turned down for being 20 pounds overweight. You know, if you've ever had a migraine headache. I mean, these aren't just people with cancer and diabetes and heart disease. These are, you know, people with pretty minor health problems that insurers will say, sorry, we don't want you. So it's tough out there. And
exactly.
If you're not going straight, you know, if you're going from a job with health insurance to another job with health insurance, then you're okay. There's a federal law to take care of that. But any other situation, it can be, the world of health insurance is a very scary and very expensive place right now.
All right. Thanks for your call, Kathy.
You're welcome.
And again, Julie, as you were saying earlier, that this doesn't look like something that that anybody's going to be able to fix, even in the next administration, whoever is the president.
Well, it's certainly fixable. It's just going to take an enormous amount of, you know, political will,
right,
and political capital. It's a big job, and it's been tried before, and nobody's been able to do it so far. And at some point, you know, it's going to get bad enough. And, you know, people have been saying, wow, we can do a $700 billion financial bailout in 2 weeks.
Right.
Why can't we do health care?
And I just want you to know that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's read an email now, and David Wellner is standing by. This one is going in your direction from Christopher in Alabama. What does the recent credit crisis stock market drop portend for the idea of privatizing Social Security? Is this idea essentially dead for good?
Well, I think this probably is a pretty fatal blow, at least for the short term, for this idea of having some of your Social Security money invested in private accounts, because it's really shown how perilous this could be, especially for people who are near to retirement. They're saying that you know, if you're within 5 years of retirement, you are in very serious trouble right now. And it's true that the money that's paid into the Social Security system has actually added up to be a surplus for many years, but because the baby boomers are now retiring, that surplus is going to turn into a deficit possibly within 15 years or so, and it's not earning that much money as it is. In fact, much of it is being raided to pay for other parts of the government that are in deficit. But at the same time, there is the good full faith and credit of the U.S. government behind those payments, and from the stock market, there are no guarantees.
All right, let's take a call from Lucille. She's calling from Syracuse, New York.
Hello.
Hi, Lucille.
Hi. First of all, I just want to say to Julie Rabner that this morning I spoke to her on the Diane Rehm show, and I was confused about the term usual and customary fee. And I have to say, Julie, thank you for correcting me on that. But the question I had that didn't get answered was, is there any way we can be guaranteed that insurance premiums will vary enough from state to state to cause prices to go down in some states as you can afford the policy as opposed to the state you live in?
Well, of course, insurance premiums are going to vary depending on what insurers have to offer. And that, currently that varies from state to state because insurers have different risk pools. They have different requirements. States have different requirements for the kinds of reserves that insurers are required to have. So, and the kind of competition that they have. And then also, you know, what it's typically charged in those states by providers. And, you know, that varies dramatically geographically. That's one of the interesting conundrums that we see in healthcare, which is that healthcare costs in Minnesota are, you know, a fraction of what they are in Florida, and yet people are not that much healthy. In fact, people are not healthier in Florida than they are in Minnesota. So that's just sort of an artifact of the way medicine is practiced. So it has to do with an awful lot of things, but it's not necessarily that you're going to get better insurance or better health care buying across state lines. In fact, there's a lot of concern that buying across state lines could cause more problems than it could solve.
I see. Thank you very much.
All right.
Much.
Thanks for your call, Lucille. Claudio, here's from Mike in San Francisco. In April, I will be in my last year of school working toward a bachelor degree in nursing. How will each candidate affect financial aid, specifically student loans?
Well, as far as Mr. Obama, his agenda includes a new tax credit to ensure that the first $4,000 of a college education is free for most students in exchange for about 100 hours of community service. It's kind of like one of the legacies of the Clinton administration, which was said, look, if you go into this field in social services or in teaching, we will forgive part or all of your loan. And that's caught on. In fact, the Bush administration supported that idea. The problem is that the program is going to cost $10 billion. Now, on Mr. McCain's side, he has said that, you know, that he wants to help support more money for the neediest students. But it's still unclear. He's not been specific about exactly how he's going to do that. So he falls in line with most Republicans in Congress these days who have said, yeah, we want to help the neediest families, but it's all got to happen in the context of what else is happening with the economy.
All right, we're going to continue this discussion after a short break. Our guests will stay with us, and we'll take more questions. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And today we're talking about three issues that may come up tonight at the debate: Social Security, health care, and education. What do you want to hear from the candidates tonight on these issues, and how are these issues playing out in your life? Tell us your story. Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Our guests are NPR reporters David Wellna, Julie Rovner, and Claudia Sanchez. And we're going to take a call now from John, who is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hello?
Hello. Go ahead, John.
Hi. My personal situation is that I'm a few years away from Social Security and Medicare both, and I'm just wondering, with the huge federal deficit, and it seems like the bailout package is likely to, or huge, sorry, the national debt, and it seems like the bailout package is likely to increase that, will there be enough money for me and millions of others of my age when we enter the system?
In a few years, you're talking now.
I'm eligible in a year for Social Security, but I understand that if I hold on till 70, I'll actually get a higher monthly payments.
David Wellna?
That's true. Yes, and in fact, let me amend something that I said earlier, which was that the Social Security would be taking in less than it's paying out in 15 years or so. That's actually more like 45 years from now. But that's making the assumption that the U.S. economy would continue to operate as it did in the year 2005 when the Congressional Budget Office made those estimates. For now, there is no chance that there would be a shortfall. There is still a huge Social Security surplus, as there is with Medicare as well. But Medicare is actually the program that has a much shorter horizon for being in the black. It's expected to start falling short within 15 years or so. And John McCain has actually proposed financing his health care plan by cutting maybe $1.3 trillion in benefits paid out through Medicare.
This morning on NPR.
All right. Well, we want to bring Julie in because she's vigorously shaking her head no, actually.
Yeah, actually,
about Medicare.
The Medicare Part A Trust Fund is already, it's not gone into the red yet, but it's actually already taking in less than it's spending. It's already spending its reserves. So it's much closer to.
So what does that mean? I mean, this gentleman specifically is saying, is it going to run out in a few years?
It's getting. I'm trying to remember exactly what the trustees said this year, but it's closer than it's been for a while. I think it's good for another 7 or 8 years. But it has flipped, and it is not taking in as much as it is spending out, and so it is now eating into the reserves of the trust fund, the Medicare trust fund. And this is only part of Medicare. This is the Medicare Part A trust fund, the part that funds hospital care, the part that funds doctor care. The Part B, there is no trust fund. That comes out of general revenues and the premiums that people pay. So that part of the program theoretically can't go broke, unless the rest of the federal government goes broke. But the Part A trust fund is what people talk about when they talk about Medicare going broke.
So, John, it sounds like you're going to have Social Security and maybe Medicare.
Yeah, Medicare needs some attention. And that's what people keep saying, is that Medicare is a much more immediate problem than Social Security. And Medicare is going to be a much more difficult problem to deal with than Social Security because, as people like to say, Social Security is just money. Medicare is basically the entire health care system. You really have to fix the incentives, what's going on in healthcare writ large, in order to fix Medicare. You can't just fix Medicare in a vacuum.
All right.
Thank you. Okay, well, on the topic of the U.S. government going broke, I mean, yesterday I wouldn't have considered that possible, but I understand that Iceland is a country that's afraid it's facing bankruptcy. Is there any conceivability that the U.S. might similarly be facing a situation in the future?
This is David Wallen again. Well, for one thing, the size of Iceland's economy compared to that of the U.S., there's really no comparison. This is a $14 trillion.
How about debt relative to GDP for the two countries?
Right. I actually don't know the ratio between the two countries. Our debt was just in the law that Congress passed last week, the bailout plan, the debt limit was raised to over $11 trillion. That's still less than what the annual GDP of the country is, but that's a higher proportion than what we've had since probably World War II in terms of what the country owes versus to how much it produces. One big difference, though, too, is that the dollar remains the worldwide currency, and so other countries, when they have surplus funds in their accounts, they buy treasury bills, and so that money still comes into the U.S. That's a situation that many other countries don't have, and it's much more like the states in the U.S. that have to worry about deficits. They can't issue their own money, and they can't expect other countries to fund them. So I think for now the U.S. appears to be solvent, but things definitely are looking bleak.
Okay, we're going to hold you to that, David, now.
All right. Ask me next week.
All right. Here's an email from Alan in California. Every election cycle, the same chestnuts are hauled out for discussion, Social Security, health care, etc., and promptly put away after the elections. Rather than just discussing the issues, I would like to see some post-election action. Health insurance company profits do not help me get medical care. In fact, they're in opposition to it, yet they seem to drive the decisions made by the health companies and government. But he's also talking about Social Security, education. You know, it's true. These are chestnuts that come out, and how come nothing ever gets done, guys?
Well, you know, the one exception, of course, was Bush 2000, who pretty much wrote in on an agenda that was trying to make, you know, the compassionate conservative idea stick. And one of the ways that he did it was by pushing, and it was, in fact, one of the first, if not the first, major legislation came out of the Bush administration in 2001 anyway, was No Child Left Behind, and which became the signature legislation for this administration. Now, what's happened to it is another story, but it was the exception to the rule, and I would agree with the listener who says, you know, they promise all this, but do they actually do anything with it? In this rare exception, I think that a lot was done in the last 8 years, at least to raise the debate, the quality of the debate, over how we can improve public education in this country.
Yeah. And healthcare, Julie, I think there's lots of attempts have been made to do something.
Well, yes, and in 2003, Congress, mostly the Republicans, did pass the Medicare drug law, which one could arguably say increased the profits of both the insurance and the drug industries by quite a lot, and have now added to Medicare's financial woes by increasing the profits of the drug and insurance industries quite a lot. But that was certainly something that the public said that they wanted, and in fairness, a lot of people are benefiting from having prescription drug coverage that Medicare did not have in the past.
All right, let's take a call from Liz, calling from Mountain Ranch, California. Hi, Liz.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
I fit three of your categories. My husband and I, he's over 50. I'm heading towards 50. We have a daughter in college. We just got one through college. And we're self-employed, and we pay for our own medical insurance coverage, which, needless to say, is extraordinarily expensive. And I had hoped that there had been light on the horizon with the election. But now with this bailout, it doesn't look like hope is on the rise as we had planned. So what is going to happen to us? Is there any light that we can look forward to?
Julie, go ahead.
You know, the health team at NPR earlier this spring went to Western Europe to see what they were doing in terms of providing health insurance to all. And I went to Switzerland, and they have a rather gold-plated healthcare system, and it's very expensive, and they pay very high taxes, and yet everybody I talked to seemed sort of remarkably satisfied. And finally, after I'd been there about a week, it dawned on me why they were so willing to pay these high taxes and to pay so much for their health insurance. And the reason was they didn't have to save to put their kids through college, and they didn't have to save for their own retirement. And it suddenly dawned on me that's why they didn't mind paying so much for healthcare, because there were these two enormous expenses that families didn't have to worry about. And it's just like this little light bulb went on. And I thought, oh, so, you know, that's why they don't mind paying these, because they have much higher out-of-pocket costs for health care than we do in the U.S., by and large. I mean, not totally. And I think that was really what it was. It's like, you know, wait a minute, college. We talked to one college student. I think her tuition was $200 a semester. And I think so. I guess, you know, my suggestion is, if you can't make ends meet, move to Switzerland.
You know, if we could, we would. And it's getting to the point where we're beginning to wonder if this country is much. I've been, you know, love it. It's just like the middle class is just getting squeezed out.
You know, I'd like to bring David Wilna into this discussion. Thanks so much for your call, Liz. And we're going to continue because, I think what Liz brings up is a question that we've touched on before, and maybe all of you can talk a little bit. But this idea of political will, and you know, of course, we've been hearing about that in all kinds of forms. The sort of divisive atmosphere that exists throughout the country and is reflected on Capitol Hill that sometimes makes it impossible to take any action on these things. David, you're up there on the Hill. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think that what we saw with the bailout bill was really the two parties that had been fighting with each other ferociously all year long really coming together and doing something. You can question whether it's going to have the desired effect, but you did get the leaders from both parties all backing this legislation, and I guess it gives a sense that at a time of crisis, the threat of things getting worse does sober a lot of the kind of froth that goes on here, and people do come together. At the same time, you have a lot of people from both parties who say, no, we should have taken more time and been more deliberative about this and not come up with any plan, but come up with a more well-thought-through plan. And, you know, I think that one thing that we can expect after November 4th is that they're almost certainly are going to be bigger Democratic majorities in both the House and the Senate. And, of course, if Barack Obama wins in November, you would have sort of the situation that you had in January of 2001 with a Republican in the White House and Republicans in control of both chambers. It was not that hard to get through those first Bush tax cuts. You know, you can really get a lot of things through Congress when you have single-party government. And I guess, you know, for the sense that Congress is deadlocked, we may not have that much of a situation if Obama is in the White House. However, if McCain wins in November, we would have divided government, and I think we would have probably a more difficult time getting a consensus on what to do next.
David Wilna is NPR's congressional correspondent, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to take another call now from Charles in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Hi, Charles.
Yes. How are you doing?
I'm good. Go ahead.
My question is about education. I have five children. We have a 4-year-old, a 6-year-old, an 8, and 9, and 10-year-old. Did I say 4? I meant 5 if I stayed. Anyways, I was wondering what the candidates might say or direction they might go to make education, college education, more affordable for our children. You know, I have, you know, possibly 7-8 years before my first child goes off to college, and you've really seen tuition skyrocket, and we've done so much to bail out different institutions that have really taken advantage of what I think is the average citizen as far as pensions and whatnot, but you really haven't seen any money put into the education system. You had George Bush coming on with the No Child Left Behind, and we obviously seen how many children were actually left behind, and I was just wondering what they think the candidates might say or actually do about making a college education more affordable for the average family.
All right, thanks so much for your call, Charles. Claudio?
On making a college education more affordable, Mr. McCain supported the big increases that most congressmen and women supported, the Pell Grants. But now we are hearing, as I had said earlier, you know, that this is a program that is already facing an enormous shortfall of $6 billion. So for all the good intentions, I mean, in the real world, students are not getting the help they need from the federal government to pay for college, which then raises the question, where are they going to get that money? Well, you know, with kids as young as yours, you're going to need to save. Now, is that possible? I don't know. There's a study out now that says that savings for college have dropped precipitously in the last year, that now, you know, if you've got grandparents who have a little bit of money, those are the people who are stepping in to help families pay for college, even in the short term. I hate to, you know, this picture of gloom and doom, but when it comes to paying for college, it is not, I repeat, it is becoming really a very difficult thing to do, and you know, something that Americans always took for granted, that if your son or daughter was eligible for a good school, they'd be able to go and they'd be able to get some help if they needed it from the federal government. That's not true anymore. And you know, something to piggyback on David Wellness' point about the climate up in the hill, bankers right now are clearly the villains that everybody is screaming at, but I think that no matter who gets elected down the road, maybe in a year or two, you're going to see college presidents come up to the Hill and get grilled for not keeping college costs down. People forget that one big reason why so many people are squeezed, you know, in terms of paying for the college education is because college costs keep going up and up and up, even in state institutions, let alone private institutions. And I think that a lot of Americans are outraged by the amount of money that a college education now costs, you know. And so I think that's going to be that's going to be addressed at some point. So it's not a pretty picture. That's what I would say to our listener. And the best I think most people can do is to try and save money for at least that first, the oldest student, so that at least he or she can make it into that school.
Right. I was going to add one thing to that, ahead, Claudia. David. This is David Wellner. A letter went out to 400 colleges and universities in the U.S. this past week from the ranking Republican on the Senate Finance Committee, Chuck Grassley of Iowa, asking them to explain what they're doing with the endowments that they have and how they're using them to help defray tuition costs. And there are some big Ivy League universities already this past year that have vastly reduced the tuition they're charging people and used some of their endowment to pay for that. But there are many, many more colleges and universities under tremendous pressure already to do likewise.
Right. Julie, I'm going to give you the last word if you want it. We just have about a minute left to wrap this up.
Yeah, and I will.
Don't get sick, right?
Yeah, don't get sick. No, I would add, actually, just to add on to what David was saying about the letter from Senator Grassley. He's been doing the same thing on the healthcare side, you know, wondering what these big, very money-making companies who are allegedly, you know, tax-free or, you know, have various tax benefits from the government are doing with some of that money. So,
thanks very much, Julie. Julie Rovner is NPR health policy correspondent. Thanks also to congressional correspondent David Wellner and NPR's education correspondent Claudio Sanchez. It was good to have you all. And this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.